introduce Paul Carr, the physicist and researcher. For nearly 30 years, he led the component technology branch of the Air Force Research Laboratory, formerly known the AF Cambridge Research Laboratory, Room Laboratory, in Bedford, Massachusetts, where his basic research on surface acoustic waves resulted in signal processing filters used in radar, communication, cell phones, and TV. Today, he's exploring the question, will faith in green technologies save us in time?
Thank you. I'll be describing my background a little toward the end of the talk. I have the references. Actually, my first environmental paper was Sacramental Water and the Challenge of Global Warming, and I presented at Boston University at a science and religion symposium there. But today, my topic is, will faith in green technologies save us in time? Faith by itself, if not accompanied by action, is dead. One to the Gospel of James, and I'll be describing some of the things that we can do, the action we can take at the end of my talk. Faith in new technologies is needed for scaling the economic viability mountain. And Bill Gates did that successfully, and I'll be talking about his, he's been doing toward the middle of my talk. So the challenge these days, what we've been observing recently, and particularly this year, climate change extremes. Dry areas are getting drier, and wet areas are getting wetter. Dry areas are wider, drier because there are more droughts, wildfires, from the higher evaporation rates. And we've seen that this summer. I'm going to be highlighting that in a few moments. But wet areas are getting wetter, floods, hurricanes, because atmosphere holds more water at higher temperatures. So this is a slide that was provided me by Tim Wallace, who's here, who has a solar panels on his roof, and he pointed and he said, this explains the smoke that we had here cutting down on my solar panels performance. You can see the fires in Western Canada. It was a very strange configuration of the atmosphere, which funneled this smoke. Under his solar arrays in Bedford, Massachusetts. Wasn't particularly dramatic then, but what was really, what has been more dramatic has been the wildfires up in north of us, up in Quebec, and the jet stream prevailing winds have brought that smoke down to New York City and southern Pennsylvania, as I'll show you. Headline, New York Times back in June 7th, wildfire smoke. Millions in North America face hazardous air quality driven by fires in Canada. You can all see many days people in New York City had to stay inside and very difficulty breathing, as you can see. And I have relatives down in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, same sort of thing at a later time. Hopefully this gets the attention of people that maybe we better do something about global warming. Here's the data. Here's some recent data, or data going back to the 1980s. The areas burned back in the 1980s was around 5 million acres, as shown here. And then it's gradually picked up, and in more recent years, it's almost doubled to about 10 million acres per year. And I'm sure when this year's data comes in, we may actually probably have a new peak. But the areas that wildfires burn has doubled since 1980. And of course, this is climate data, because of course, a single year is not climate. Climate is a long-term trend, and the long-term trend, I think, is very clear. Well, you're probably familiar with this book by Catherine Hayhoe. She spoke at our ASA symposium in Golden, Colorado in 2017, a very impressive talk. That's why I bought this book, Saving Us, a Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing. Her main theme for this title is our planet Earth will survive, but not necessarily present civilization as we know it. The
percentage of people who are seriously concerned about climate change has been increasing. She did cite this this poll in her book. There are people on the extreme who say, oh, it's a hoax. But the people who are seriously concerned has gone up somewhat at the point of the survey. Everybody else is pretty much the same, but sometimes that's some good news that the percentage of people who are seriously concerned has been increasing. Well, let's talk about Bill Gates, his next generation solar nuclear reactor to be being built now in Wyoming. Of course, Bill Gates had faith in the emergent personal computer technology. We all know about the success of Microsoft. But now he's putting his faith into action in terms of next generation nuclear reactors for generating carbon-free electricity. This is a summary or schematic of what he's doing. Presently, and there are a lot of coal-fired electric generating plants in Wyoming and also the rest of the country, but you can see coal generation is characterized, of course, by carbon dioxide and smoke emissions. But the purpose of the coal burning is to produce steam, and the steam turns the vanes of a turbine, which generates electricity. And Bill Gates is in the process of replacing this coal-fired plant by a nuclear, small modular nuclear reactor, which also produces steam, as you can see, and that steam from the nuclear plant will now be, when he's done, will be powered, cause the turbine wheels to turn, and of course this is green energy as opposed to the recruiting carbon dioxide and smoke from a coal plant. And these small nuclear reactors, by the way, use heat generated by the reactor at the bottom of the this vertical reactor here shown. So the steam produces water. It's a water-cooled reactor, so the water boils and in this reactor and produces steam. That's how nuclear reactors work. So. Well, the overall theme, what we'd like to see happen, is ecology trumping economics. In actuality, I think it's unfortunately the other way around. Economic trumps ecology. But just a summary of what I've been telling you, non-carbon emitting electricity, 24/7. Now, wind and solar are green, and they don't emit carbon dioxide, but on the average, they're only there 33% of the time. Bill Gates' breakthrough technologies include small modular fission reactors, expediting the coal to nuclear revolution in 19. And we expect these small modular reactors will be available and online and working toward the end of the decade. And Gates and others are investing $1.8 billion in fusion reactors under development. Particularly all over the country, but particularly Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which is an MIT spinoff in the Cambridge area. And they're in the process of demonstrating the potential for generating green energy by 2030 via fission reactors. And fission reactors have the advantage that there's no radioactive waste. That's their big advantage. I might mention that the particular breakthrough that Commonwealth Fusion Systems is exploiting, they're using the latest generation of superconducting magnets. And this enables the size of the magnets to be much smaller than, for example, the International Thermoelectric Nuclear Reactor in southern France. And that's why it's expected to generate and demonstrate the viability of fusion generate electricity by 2030 before the one in southern France. Basically, the high temperature magnets have produced the world's largest magnetic fields, about 21 Teslas. I used to use electromagnets in my research, and we were dealing with much smaller electric fields than I got with conventional electromagnet. However, new technologies like deep geothermal and green hydrogen will cause carbon concentrations to level off. But it will be centuries that the carbon dioxide half-life before they decrease. And I'm going to argue for the advantage that carbon capture is immediate. Will carbon capture and utilization become more economical? Well, this is the where we're at now. This is the carbon dioxide emissions. We're presently about 420 parts per million. And of course they're increasing. So let's look forward to the future. China, for example, has said that their carbon dioxide emissions will peak and start decreasing, level off, and go down by around 2060. Of course, right now, China is the world's largest carbon dioxide emitter. But does anyone know which country, on a per-person basis, which country has the largest carbon dioxide emissions per capita?
Yeah, that's good.
No, I don't know about Canada. I don't have data for Canada. It could be, but I know it's the United States. The data that I have is the United States. Canada, I really don't know what it is for Canada. But in any case, there are conservatives who say, why should we cut back on our carbon dioxide emissions because China's the world's biggest emitter and why should we care? Well, at least we are more responsible in the sense that our emissions per person are about twice that of China. So from that point of view, I think it makes us more responsible. But anyway, I'm arguing that if we capture and sequester, the CO2 concentrations would decrease in proportion to that rule. Here we are in 2060. Okay. The world emissions will be going down, but you can see what's happening to the carbon dioxide emission. It's still going up at a slower rate. And this is a result of the fact that carbon dioxide half-life, due to natural absorption like the ocean and soil and so forth, takes, the half-life is the order of a century. So we're not going to see any benefit from the solar panels that you just saw. But if we can pull that carbon out of the atmosphere, it's emitted in proportion to the rate at which you move it. So Mark Schott, who's senior director of carbon capture at Honeywell, says we can capture CO2 economically. The big CO2 capture from the smokestack is the most economical because it's more dense there. Of course, there's also direct air capture, which is more difficult because the carbon dioxide emissions are intensely lower. But the big problem is what can we do with the captured CO2? Any suggestions, by the way, what to do with it?
Grow forests.
Right? Well, forests, that's right, forests do that for us. If they plant more trees, that's certainly a solution, yeah.
How about limestone bricks?
Right, that's another way of capturing and tying it up as a chemical compound. And that I think is a key chemical reaction. And as a matter of fact, here's an example of a UK startup which is using the absorbed carbon dioxide tied up in a chemical compound, maybe like calcium carbonate or limestone, and they're using it to make drywall. And of course, drywall is something you can sell, so it makes it economically viable. So carbon capture and utilization for a sellable product, that's what we need. We need more of that at a larger scale. Here's an example, though, of carbon capture and utilization, CCU, at a coal plant in Texas. Essentially, this plant in Thompson's, Texas, was the only U.S. power plant to successfully capture carbon dioxide from post-combustion at a commercial scale. The CO2 was compressed and piped into an oil field for enhanced oil recovery. The system operated from 2017 to 20. However, when low oil prices made capture uneconomical, there's a case of economics trumping ecology. And they were all set up and selling the carbon dioxide to the oil producers, but it became economical when the price of the price of oil, that's the state. But you can see here's a coal plant with emitting a particle of carbon dioxide and also smoke with lots of particles in it. So let me just read this to you. This is an article that was just published in Physics Today. Capture alone isn't sufficient to bottle up carbon dioxide. U.S. has practically boundless capacity to store carbon dioxide. It just needs to find a way to do it. Combined billions of dollars with federal tax subsidies combined with enhanced tax credits have stimulated dozens of new carbon capture and storage and direct air capture projects in the U.S., but a severe bottleneck in the regulatory process for transport and storage is slowing progress toward meeting the goal of the Biden administration to reach net zero emissions by 2050. The 2021 Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Job Acts appropriated more than $10 billion in R&D and demonstration project funding for 5 years for carbon capture and storage and direct air capture. And at least a year's inflation reduction, at last year's Inflation Reduction Act provided a powerful incentive to projects that lock up carbon dioxide, raising the carbon credit for capture and permanent storage of CO2 to $85 per ton from its previous level of $50. The credit was elevated to $35 to $50 per ton if the CO2 is utilized for coal production and other applications, such as incorporating it into concrete and building material. That's another example of incorporating. I gave the example of using the captured carbon dioxide for Walhorn, and another application is to use it to basically sequester it in concrete, which is obviously a marketable product. So this is the technology that I think we need to really emphasize. And you can see it's getting a boost from this Inflation Reduction Act. Well, what can people of faith do now? There's a book out called Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, edited by Paul Huckett. And of 100 ways of reducing global warming, the following were rated as shown. A plant-rich diet, reduce food waste. Distributed photovoltaics come in 8. You just saw that in the previous talk. Electric cars, which I got bought one in 2017, and it's a fun way to save our planet. I was a little disappointed that it was only rated at 41. I know Tim Wallace just bought one for his wife. It's a fun way to save our planet. This is some data I took from Drawdown. This is the actual chart. Solutions, which you can find easy go to drawdown.org, solutions, table of solutions. And here they're ranked according to the amount of carbon dioxide equivalent that you save by the technology. You can see utility scale photovoltaics is second on the list, whereas, as I told you, three on the list is a plant-rich diet. Now, the argument is, food, it cuts down mainly on the methane emissions, which is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, which we get from livestock. It comes out both ends, from the manure and from the digestive systems. So that's why it's ranked number 3, and also reduce food waste. Now, this is something that we can all
start doing immediately, probably after tonight's barbecue. After you've enjoyed, hopefully this will be your last beef. Because by the way, beef is the equivalent carbon dioxide of beef production is the highest. You're much better off if you eat chicken, and that's what we've been doing. And of course, chicken is better for your heart, lower cholesterol. So plant-rich diet and chicken is much better than beef. You notice also, I thought clean cooking is on the, well, I'll just show you here. This is the distributed photovoltaics that you heard about. You can see the clock, it's rated at 64 carbon equivalent. Here, let me just show you. Distributed photovoltaics, which is rooftop solar, as you can see, rated at 64. Whereas if you go to the utility scale voltaics, it's about twice that. And that's a good economy of scale. I mean, that you could have whole fields of utility scale utilities. And of course, there's more labor involved in putting those panels on your roof and tying it into your electric box. To wind up here, well, faith in green technology, save us in time. We must act quickly before our Earth reaches runaway tipping point where human mitigation will have little effect. CO2 is a half-life of a century. Carbon capture and utilization has an immediate impact, should be emphasized. The benefits of reducing CO2 emissions will not be evident for all the things that we're doing today. I mean, the money we're spending, we won't see any benefits in terms of reduced weather extremes for over a century. So it's going to take faith to believe that climate science is telling that in about a century, CO2 emissions from natural CO2 reductions from natural processes are going to take over a century. Whereas if you pull it out of the atmosphere, we get an immediate benefit. So immediately after a Canadian barbecue, we should eat a more vegetarian diet and reduce the greenhouse emissions for agriculture and animals. This will probably be my last chance tonight. I have maybe some ribs or whatever. But after that, let's stick to chicken and white meat. Just some references to earlier talk. My first talk on some references. This is one that I gave in 2018. What is climate change doing to us? This is my most complete paper published in Zygon, Journal of Religion and Science. And my most recent reference was, I mentioned, David Kramer's carbon capture article in Physics Today, which I showed you the title page of that. This is a book that I just published recently, Loves in My Life, and How I Became Interested in Science and Religion, and more recently in Climate Change. So thank you.
I thank you so much for your talk and your work and your ongoing advocacy. I wonder if you would comment on how much work is being done to restore oxygen to the atmosphere. We talk a lot about carbon dioxide, and we talk about storage of carbon dioxide, but we're not talking about the release of oxygen back into the atmosphere and around the Earth. So would you mention some work that's going on in that realm?
Yeah, I think you're making a very important point. You know, all the curves show carbon dioxide going up, but they're also curves showing that the amount of oxygen in our atmosphere is going down, which is vital for life as we know it. Quite frankly, planting more trees is about the only thing I can think of right now. I mean, there are articles showing that planting more trees will have a big effect, but unfortunately, we're doing just the opposite. These wildfires are doing just the opposite. They're cutting down the number of the forest, and the Amazon being cut down for economic reasons. And I understand I know the Environmental Defense Fund is trying to offer I think we basically have to offer economic subsidies to some of these developing countries not to cut down their jungle, because it's negatively impacting. And as they say, the trees are great because they basically take carbon dioxide out of the air, convert it into oxygen, and store the carbon as wood.
Thank you for your talk. I really heard that promising tax solutions to help with the climate crisis. But I guess I was wondering, thinking more broadly, it seems that CO2 emissions are just a piece of a larger problem that we have of overconsumption in our global society. And so I guess I'm wondering whether we should also be thinking about reframing the economic system itself so that we're not worried about what's economical, but rather what's ecological and what we can plan collectively to meet our needs and ecology's needs.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, there are, I know, there. I don't know, there's a first, there is a person that we need to change our whole economic system and make it more ecological. It is interesting that all the economists say that a carbon tax or a carbon fee is the most economical way of bringing carbon dioxide emissions down. I know there's an organization that's Citizens Climate Lobby has been advocating a proposal by a former Treasury Secretary, Charles Schulz, which is basically we put a fee on carbon. Once you put a fee on carbon, then the cost of gas, and I understand that's happening in Canada right now. Canada, people are nodding their heads, and Canada does have a carbon tax. But our legislature in Washington, D.C. Has not been able, I know we had a carbon cap and trade bill came out of the House of Representatives in about, it was 2009, but the Senate never acted on it. And you notice this latest bill does not have any carbon fee, but it gives a tax rewards or tax incentives for green technology. In other words, we just heard that former talk that if you put in solar panels on your roof, you get government rebates on your taxes. And then similarly, if you put in a heat pump or so forth, there are government subsidies now which will reduce the cost of green technology. So in a sense, the United States, we're reducing the cost of, we're giving you tax incentives, but the idea of the more economical way is just simply to put I might mention that Schulz's proposal was to, if we put a fee on carbon, there'll be a lot of money generated. And what's going to happen to that money? Well, his proposal was to give it back to everybody to pay for their higher energy bills. And if the average person is going to, with a carbon fee on gasoline, it's going to cost a lot more to drive your automobile to get to work. Well, this Schulz's idea was, okay, a family of four but that money that the carbon producers are paid is going to be distributed to everybody. So the average family of four would get maybe $2,000 a year of a government subsidy to pay for their higher gasoline and for their higher electricity costs. Right now, most electricity is generated with natural gas, which emits carbon. So the cost of fossil fuels for the customer would go up, but they'd have more money to pay for it. But at the same time, non-carbon emitting sources like wind, solar, nuclear would have a big advantage at the economically. Yeah. Yes.
One big last question here.
Yeah, I'm noticing more and more students are talking about having no children anymore, and that's the responsible thing to do. And I'm wondering, from a Christian perspective, like, is it time to stop being fruitful and multiplying, or is it one having children that are walking more lightly on the earth? I mean, like, this is an honest discussion among many young people. And what is a Christian sort of perspective of how to responsibly navigate all of that?
That's a very good point. Actually, I was interested. The summary of sustainability was enough for everyone, for everybody. And I said to myself, well, if there are fewer everybody's, the need for you know, food and whatever is going to go down. I mean, just if there were fewer people, they would obviously, if there were fewer people using, eating or burning gas, there obviously is going to be, you know, there's going to be less carbon dioxide emitted. So that is a, that is a, but on the other hand, and as you probably read in the news that China had a no child policy, and their population is going down. But there are sacrifices involved with that. People our age that are on Social Security, there are going to be more retired people getting Social Security, and there won't be enough young people to pay to support us. And that is a problem when you have more old people who can't work and need government support. Where are the young people? You know, where are the young people that are going to? Working people have been putting money into Social Security. There are problems each way, every way, but long term. Well, actually, you know, if you just look at the demographics of Europe, South Korea, populations are going down. In other words, for a sustainable population, it's 2.1 births per woman, and it's significantly lower than that in Europe. In Russia, and even the United States, it would be true, and the only way we keep our population up is by immigration. So civilized countries are already doing it, and it's the third world where sub-Saharan Africa, and of course these countries that are dependent on family farms, their social security is having children. In other words, if you don't have government Social Security and you own a farm, when you're not able to work, if you have a lot of kids, they will run your farm and feed you. So that's one of the reasons why third world countries still have are having a lot of kids, because that's their Social Security.
Well, thank you, Paul. Let's thank all of our speakers.